Today's program was brought to you by Franco Lania's Minnesota Wild Rice Griddle Cakes. For more information, visit francolania.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
This week, of course, began with the shocking news that chef Benoit Violet of Restaurant de l'Hôtel de Ville in Crissier had died in what is still being called an apparent suicide. We have three guests here to talk about kitchen pressure in the wake of that news. Michael Lasconis, Paul Liebrandt, and Matthias Merges. But first, on a very different note, we just wanted to quickly touch on something that just broke yesterday. On the website First We Feast, there was an article called "The Problems with Food Media That Nobody Wants to Talk About." Jimmy, take it away.
Whoa, hot potato. I might leave that one to the writer in the room.
All right. I'll go ahead and jump in. You have a week to get comfortable with this subject.
Thank you for my grace period.
But Chris Schoenberger and Justin Beloy, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Justin, wrote a piece called "The Problems with Food Media That Nobody Wants to Talk About." I just personally want to send, as a number of writers did on Twitter and elsewhere yesterday, a huge thank you to these guys. I thought this was an important piece. I think it was something that, I'm not sure why, but it's been a little more well-received than other pieces that have tried to take this topic on. The sort of top lines of this were, and a lot of these are just barely adapted versions of the subheads in the piece, the food media has gone a little soft, that writers are afraid to lose access to chefs by writing in a less than a buoyant way about them, that people only feel safe tearing down industry idols when someone else has gone ahead of them. And then there's sort of this kind of feeding frenzy that happens on social media, a lack of diversity in the food writing ranks. Important conversations aren't really happening in our big magazines anymore. The lists that come out, in particular, they pointed to the airing of grievances that happens on Eater annually. That PR has too much influence. You know what, Jimmy? This is kind of a hot potato list. Maybe yes. I'll have to go into hiding after reading this. recipes don't work anymore. And hot lists, hype, first impression reviews that come out, you know, within a couple of days of a restaurant opening. This just broke yesterday. We were hoping to maybe get Chris Schoenberger on, who's also the editor-in-chief of the website. Notice was a little too short, but I'm happy to say Chris is going to be in the studio next week.
That's going to be great.
And we're going to talk about this piece and what the week after the piece was like. And we will also have Chris participating in our roundtable about whatever news happens between now and then. So we'll look forward to that. And we're now going to shift gears and get back to, again, this was something we all woke up to on Monday. And Jimmy, just before we bring our guests into this conversation, you know, anytime you read news like this, obviously it's a sad thing. But, you know, for you as a chef, how did it hit you in a way that maybe it didn't hit someone else who was just reading this, you know, in the paper on or online first thing on Monday?
Right. I mean, besides the incredibly sad, you know, aspect of it, there's a lot of pressure on chefs, you know, both internal and external. And I'm not sure how much folks outside of the industry know about it. And, you know, I know, you know, for myself and my career, and I know what it's like at the Red Cat, I can only just imagine what it's like at the highest 3-star Michelin level.
Right. So with, you know, it's funny, there's a number of threads, I think, that run through some of what we've been doing on the show in the last few weeks. Kat Kinsman was on 3 weeks ago to talk about her program, Chefs with Issues, which is about mental health in the kitchen. She's taking that on. She just started at the beginning of the year, is getting a lot of attention, was featured in a New York Times piece about the suicide the other day.
Right, and Andrew Zimmern takes on the drug and alcohol side of it, and both are doing great work in putting these topics at the, you know, the forefront of a conversation we should be having.
Agreed. So with that in mind, what we thought we would touch on today is sort of go a little bit deeper into something that seems to be a part of this whole conversation, which is kitchen pressure. What it's the pressures on cooks and chefs is like, and specifically what it's like at the highest level. There is an interesting through line to some of these, to all these stories, really. There's Chef Viollet's death this week, Homaro Cantu in Chicago last year, very famously Bernard Lusseau, gosh, I guess 13 years ago. It is believed in anticipation of perhaps losing a Michelin star. But these are all people who operate in the Michelin level. You know, it's something we'll talk about later in the show, what the sort of anxieties of that goal and that world are. But first, I'd like to just start by talking about this subject very generally. And let's introduce our guests. We have in the studio with us Michael Lisconis, former pastry chef of Le Bernardin in New York City, which held and continues to hold 3 Michelin stars, and currently creative director at the Institute for Culinary Education in New York City, where he's been since 2012. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
We have here also in the studio Chef Paul Liebrandt, who's been the chef of such acclaimed New York City restaurants as Atlas and Gilt, and of course Cortone, where he earned 2 Michelin stars. He was also the subject, of course, of the documentary Matter of Taste and the book To the Bone, which full disclosure requires that I say I collaborated on with him. Paul's smiling. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning.
And by telephone from Chicago, we have Chef Matthias Merges of Yusho, A10, Billy Sunday, and of course, before all of that, Chef de Cuisine at Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. Welcome, Matthias.
Thanks for having me on.
I thought I would just start, and I'll only do this twice, but a couple, having worked with Paul on his book, there's a passage that came immediately to my mind even before we were talking about this show. And it's about certain the pressures of high-performance kitchens, and I'll just read this. This is Paul's comments. One of the most iconic images of chefs, especially European ones, is that of the temperamental taskmaster, hurling sauté pans at young cooks and cursing everybody from the front of the house staff to the customers. It's become a cartoon image, but in reality, these figures are as terrifying as an abusive parent. In my early days, it hit me that some chefs thought nothing of screaming the most insulting, personal, and hurtful comments at their minions. The most awful thing I ever witnessed was the morning a young cook walked into work, his face a mush of pain, and told the chef his father had died during the night and he'd need to miss a day of work. "What are you going to do about it?" asked the chef. "He's gone. Work your shift and take care of your affairs afterwards." There's not much I can add to the canon of well-publicized incidents in this genre, except to say that everything you might have heard is true. I can also confess that I myself have been known to raise my voice an octave or 10 in the kitchen. You know what they say, those who are abused as children are the most likely to abuse as adults. While I've moderated my tone over the years, I'd be lying if I said that I completely regret my outburst, because it produces the desired result, and that's worth a lot in a kitchen, more than almost any other consideration. Paul, as I read this to you, I mean, you came up in a lot of the type of kitchens that we're talking about. You worked for Marco Pierre White when you were still a teenager. You worked for Pierre Gagnaire. You worked for Raymond Blanc, Richard Neat. How has your thinking about this aspect of kitchen life evolved over the years, and is that still what it takes to get the highest performance out of cooks and chefs de partie and whoever else might be on your team?
Well, I would say that the culture that I grew up in and the culture that I trained in is very different to today. It has evolved. It is much less physical and mental stress now than it was when I was training 20 years ago. And that's just an evolution as kitchens go, that it's become more of a nurturing aspect now in those kitchens as it was when I was training. I think to get the results that you need, when I was younger, yes, I would sort of go to the phrase of you need to have a hard taskmaster in order to get what you need, because that's the way I was trained. Now I'm a little older, I would say it's probably not the most efficient way in order to get the best out of a young person at all. It's much easier to push someone in the right way than it is to push them in the wrong way. Yeah.
Does that include, I would assume, perhaps adjusting how you manage different individuals? Are there different ways of getting the best performance out of different people? And is that part of the evolution of this topic that you're talking about?
Absolutely. Everybody is different. Everybody has their own personality. And especially within a kitchen, which draws a lot of different personalities into the world of restaurants. Some people you have to be very different with to others. And that is just the nature of the personalities that we are. Certain things never change in the kitchen, standard-wise, things that you have to hold yourself and your team accountable for. But I think that there's just a different and better way to approach it than, let's say, than when I was growing up in the kitchens, where it was really, it was like being in the army. So it was...
And is that evolution that you're describing, what do you think is responsible for that? In other words, is it just kind of coming along with society and the way there's just been kind of more sensitivity, I'll call it, to how you get more out of people? You know, you might have somebody, a child these days, who is diagnosed with ADHD and gets treated, whereas years ago, you know, people would say, you know, just smack the kid and, you know, send him back to school and he'll be fine. Do you consider this just part of sort of a societal evolution and improvement?
Absolutely. I think that society has progressed greatly in the past 20 years in every way, but especially in kitchens, because if you look back 20 years ago and go back 20 from there and keep going back, it hadn't really changed that much. The way the brigade system, the French, like Michelin level we're talking about here, hadn't changed. From Escoffier to Carême, it was hard work, physical, mental, it's very demanding. It's hot in the kitchen, it's a lot of stress, and it is something that hadn't really evolved. In most other professions, there is much more evolution with work standards and ethics. If you think 100 years ago when child labor was accepted, and now, you know, in most parts of the developed world, that you wouldn't even think about it.
Right.
But in kitchens, to work 15, 17 hours a day and be screamed at for pennies, literally an hour, was normal. And the past 20 years, with the evolution of the media in regards to shining a light on what we do in the kitchen, has most definitely brought into the sort of the sex appeal, in a way, of kitchens and food and chefs. And therefore, you cannot operate necessarily in the way that you did prior. So it has evolved for the better, absolutely for the better. There are good and bad things about it, but I think that it's necessary to be the way it is today. Absolutely.
Thank you. Jimmy?
Yeah, I wanted to speak to you, Michael, for a moment. I guess you moved on from Le Bernardin in 2012 and, you know, joined on as a director at the creative director at the Institute of Culinary Education. Did you feel there was a need to step away? Did you need a break from the pressures of the 3-star Michelin environment?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of reasons for wanting to kind of step aside, and part of that was, I mean, I think subconsciously I just wanted a different rhythm to my life, but I was, because that came about the time where we were doing a huge remodel. So we kind of all anticipated the review cycle to come again, and I was dreading it, because, you know, the one thing, you know, as a young cook coming up, you know, my ultimate goal was 4 stars from the New York Times, 3 Michelin stars. Nobody talks about what it takes to maintain that and sustain that, and those pressures are real, and there, you know, I'm not going to lie, there was a little bit of relief and that I kind of got out before that review cycle.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. You know, the maintaining of it is maybe even more taxing than the actual getting your first high acclaim.
Exactly.
And then how about the give back? You know, been working into school and working with the young minds. I mean, I know you're working with young minds at work, but you know, these are kids that are paying you to teach them vice versa in your workplace. Where does that factor into the move?
I mean, it certainly, I realized at some point that, you know, as a chef in that kind of environment, most of my job was mentoring anyway. You know, so I've just been expanding upon that. But, you know, I also get that itch to get back into the kitchen. So I've been working a lot of projects over the years that get me back in the kitchen. And you know, I still do thrive on that.
Can you speak to, or is there a difference in the youth that you're training from when you're training them in the kitchen, you know, over the past over your career and now the ones that you're influencing in the educational field?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think, you know, I've been seeing this transition over the last couple of years where the average age of the student is getting younger. So what that's telling us is that, you know, kids today, they want to go into this profession. You know, whether it's, you know, necessarily always for the right reasons. You know, I think there's still a perception of, you know, the chef as a rock star as something to aspire to, and that hard work isn't necessarily, you know, the realities aren't always thrust out in front of them. But I think a great deal of, you know, passionate young cooks are coming into the field.
Nice. And you're gonna split your time a little bit coming up soon. Can we speak about that?
Sure.
So will you elaborate on what you're going to be doing?
I kind of feel overemployed at the moment. So in addition to my role at ICE, I'm also working on a few restaurant projects, and including the imminently opening La Sirena in the Maritime Hotel.
I have to imagine there's a lot of pressure in spreading yourself thin, just as much as there is trying to get and maintain the stars. Is there a difference in those pressures, or how you work with them?
Sure. Well, you know, again, leaving a position like Le Bernardin, you know, I wasn't going to make a lateral move. That didn't really make much sense. But I think what I realized that I wanted was that no 2 days be exactly alike. And I kind of totally got that right now.
Yeah, careful what you wish for, right?
You know, I still work 70 hours a week. I guess I can choose which 70 hours I want to work. But no, I mean, yeah, ironically, you know, I'm going to be facing the review cycle again soon.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, you know, as chefs, we picked it. So thank you for sharing. That was very, very insightful.
Matthias.
Yes, sir.
Who's been sitting patiently listening to our conversation here in New York. I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd love to just talk about your earlier career, because I think it's a very, again, you know, it's something that does seem to come up in this, some of these unfortunate stories we've been hearing. You spent several years sort of stewarding the kitchen at Charlie Trotter's. I mean, obviously, Chef Trotter was still there. But you were in a very important role. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to the unique pressures of having a position of responsibility with an institution. It would seem to me that would be something unlike, you know, building something yourself, where it's sort of just your own thing on the line and your own ambition. But what were those years like in terms of the pressure both on yourself and coming from outside?
Well, it was definitely a very unique experience I had with working with Charlie. He was definitely the taskmaster, and he set the vision out for what he wanted. And I think that what he did for us is he put the pressure back on us, saying that this is a vision, this is where we want to be, now you need to go and get there. So he was very good at the visionary scope, and he was really hands-off as far as what the menu would be, or how we would work with the staff and the brigade, and how we would nurture and train. And I think that was something that actually excelled the pressure with the position I had as well. I was kind of like the insulator between Charlie and the staff of the restaurants when they open. And it was particularly interesting because we both have very different personalities as far as the way we like to operate and get things done. And you know, harkening back to Chef Paul and kind of like where everyone came from. I remember spending time in Paris at Robichon in 95 when it was like hardcore, people in your face, yelling and screaming and punching. And then I realized then that there had to be a change, because only when a cook feels great about themselves and what they do can you have exceptional products and exceptional food. You know, helping them realize their full potential, I think when you grasp that kind of idea, that really wonderful things can happen. And I also think, you know, going back to the last conversation, I think that there's a different employee that's coming through the ranks. I think that, you know, over the past 40 years, it's turned from a blue-collar work to white-collar work. And you have a more educated, smarter talent pool. The work ethic might be questionable, as we all know, but I think that they're definitely a smarter group of people coming through.
Yeah, I've actually noticed that myself. That's been a very interesting evolution that's happening. I'd love to just, not so much challenge, but I'd love to just come back on something you just said, and maybe after you talk, I'd invite Paul or Michael to get in on this if they want. But I'm just wondering, when you say, you know, when you were overseas and you saw this type of behavior in the kitchens, you realized something had to change. I know a lot of chefs in their mid-50s to early mid-60s who actually pine for those days. They feel like, you know, the sort of boot camp nature of kitchens produced basically soldiers.
Exactly right.
And that they feel like this sort of time of human resource departments you know, the sort of evolved thing that you were just describing, they actually feel like that, you know, that isn't necessarily producing the most dependable cooks, the ones who you can really count on, the ones who, you know, will absolutely do anything to be at work and finish the shift and all that. I know guys, and maybe not so much women, actually, to be honest, but I know a lot of guys who almost pine for those days. Do you hear that? Is this a conversation you've had? Have you had? Do you find yourself at odds with sort of other thinking on this that you might hear from other chefs?
I think there's definitely, you know, looking back at those days, people call, oh, the glory days of working in the kitchen, and we work 17 hours a day, 6 days a week, and, you know, I can work a station and put out 400 plates. That's an ego-driven kind of, like, I wish I was young again so I could go back and run a marathon kind of thing. And I think that that kind of mentality and that thinking in a kitchen is over. I think that people need to... You know, when I was in Japan, and I worked at a few great restaurants there, and one day, here's a little story for you. So the chef turned to me, and he says, he goes, you will never be a great chef until you learn how to kill your own ego. And that was, like, one of the most, you know, salient points in my life of, like, what does that mean, and how do I apply it? And that's when I really turned and said, my job now is to nurture every single person in this restaurant, to help them realize their full potential and make them better people. And as you look at the people who came through Trotters over the, you know, the 14 years that myself and Charlie worked together, from John Shields and Karen Urey to Marcus Glocker and John Winterman to, you know, the restaurant producing the most master sommeliers out of any restaurant on the planet, it's like that kind of, when we made that switch mentally at the restaurant, more creative, better things started to happen. And I think that that's kind of like, you know, where my headspace is.
Great. Thank you. Anything, Michael, Paul, anything on this?
I mean, it's funny because years ago I coined a phrase. It was, you know, we were in a service and, you know, somebody had a stomach ache or a headache or something. And I, to kind of egg them on, I was like, it's not cuisine or I have a headache. It's cuisine or death. You know, and I still kind of tongue in cheek, you know, use that phrase a little bit, but you know, it's interesting. And I think I could talk about this 'cause he's talked about it publicly, but, you know, Eric Repair, you know, maybe it's really his generation that is responsible for this shift in kitchens, you know, as tough as Le Bernardin, you know, was and is, you know, he refers to his days at Jamin with Robuchon, you know, as his dark days. Like I think he does not pine for those days. You know, so I think it's maybe, you know, that generation of chefs who've helped kind of evolve the kitchen culture.
Great. Thank you. We are going to take a break. And when the Front Burner returns, we're going to pick up this conversation on pressure in the kitchen. We'll be right back.
October of 2013, Chef Frank Alania happily found himself in Marshall, Minnesota. Showing true Minnesota hospitality, Franco's hosts invited him to an afternoon of Midwest fun. They visited, among other things, a nearby bison farm and even a local shooting club. The only stipulation was that the men wanted a meal prepared by this master chef at the club's lodge. Franco worked his magic in the kitchen using locally available pumpkins, squashes, kale, bison steaks, and Minnesota wild rice. As a classically trained chef, Franco often made a risotto rice pancake. Franco substituted wild rice for the risotto and added some secret ingredients to his new recipe. Voila! Chef Franco's Minnesota wild rice griddle cakes were born. Now you too can enjoy these delicious griddle cakes and all the healthful benefits of wild rice. Purchase your very own box and help support a very time-honored American product, wild rice from Minnesota. For more information, visit francolania.com.
And welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We are discussing pressure in the kitchen with chefs Michael Lascanis, Paul Liebrandt, and Matthias Merges. Paul, I'd like to start this part of the conversation with you. It's something that Michael teed up really well in the last segment, but this whole question of stars. We did a show last week on chefs and critics, and we had a whole discussion about the star system. We were mainly talking about the New York Times, or actually generally, I guess I would say, we were talking about stars and sort of, you know, what the ups and downs of stars are. Some of the chefs who were in the conversation like them, some don't. Some writers like them, some don't. But with it's something I think that restaurants have to contend with that you don't really contend with in many other creative fields. It's there are some exceptions, I guess. There are movie critics maybe who give stars. But by and large, you don't see a piece about an art exhibition with stars attached to it. You don't see music reviews with stars attached to it, generally speaking. You know, restaurants, you have this moment where you have a number of stars assigned to you, and you have to sort of, live with that for a long period of time. And then there's the whole special case of the Michelin stars, which if you came up in a certain culture, you probably don't resent that system. It's something that you really aspire to, that you really want Michelin stars. Paul, you obviously came up in this world where Michelin was a hugely important thing. You got 2 stars right out of the box at Cortone, which is not a normal thing. Can you just speak to, A, what those stars mean for someone of your background, and B, what the pressures are of anticipating and then maintaining those stars?
Well, for myself, you know, I came up in the European culture where Michelin ruled everything. And when I was training, this is before blogs and, internet chat rooms with people rating and what have you, the eaters of the world. Michelin guide, I think, more than the stars, is that it's a guide that has been around for over 100 years. The standards that they set are the highest in globally for judgment of what they deem a restaurant needs to be in order to be a 1, 2, or 3 star. And I think it's just something which it's not a guide which obviously is particularly regional to any one part of the world. I mean, a three-star Michelin is, you know, worth a special journey there. Anywhere in the world, there's a standard to be had, and you can trust and relate about trust. So, you know, with regards to that, it's something that you aspire to do. It's like winning an Oscar. You want to give your best, and, you know, the stars are really a chef thing, I suppose. You know, it's testing yourself and giving your customers, obviously, a high standard that, in turn, that they enjoy and come back for. So that part of it, I think, kind of sells itself. As far as the pressures go of running, you know, multiple Michelin-starred kitchen and restaurant, you know, honestly, it's got to do with the individual person who's the chef or owner, or what have you, of the establishment. Really, when I cook, when I work, yes, the stars are important, but I'm not there cooking for the stars. I cook for my own standards, and I cook for what I hope my guests enjoy. And if I'm deemed worthy of a certain level, then that's great. But I don't cook solely, if I do this, I will get certain amount of stars, and that's why I'm doing it. No. The challenge, and actually it's a great challenge, is the consistency of having to do it every day, keeping up. That's really the fun part for me personally.
It's interesting to me that you said multiple starred restaurant, because I've known actually a couple of chefs who have made the comment to me individually in different states, just in conversation, people who had one Michelin star and said, you know what, I'm good. You know, I don't have that much to lose. I'm not shooting for any higher than this. Mm. This feels fine for me. I'll take this and, you know, I'll run. You're nodding as I said. Do you relate to that mindset at all? Does that?
No. Not at all.
Yeah. No. And when you talk about this history, I think it's just an interesting point you put on it. The amount of history behind that, that guide, and also the worldwide nature of it. You know, I've jokingly said that to me, you know, the Times critics at some point, I start to think of them as like the James Bonds, the actors who have played James Bond, right? Everyone has their favorite. There's sort of, you know, the two, you know, there's the Daniel Craig and the Sean Connery are sort of the best. And at the low end, there's like Lazenby. And then, you know, everyone probably has their New York Times critics that they would assign to those boxes. But the Michelin Guide is not personalized in that
way. Well, I mean, anywhere, anything in life, when you are being critiqued, there is personal.
No, I mean, the reviewers are not individual personalities.
But the people that review you, they have their likes and dislikes, too.
Yeah. You're just not as...
So Michelin is not perfect, as nothing is perfect. They make some would say, egregious demotions or additions to the starred categories. But the fun thing from being in my position as a chef is that every year you have the chance to go up or down. Unlike when you get reviewed, whether it's the New York Times or it's the Telegraph in London or a more regional publication... You get reviewed by the Times. I mean, you might not get reviewed for the next 4 or 5 years, and you're stuck with a star attachment to your restaurant that you may or may not like.
Sure.
At least with Michelin, every year the guy comes out, every year you have a chance to improve and at least shoot for that next level, which keeps you on your toes.
Okay, thank you. Jimmy, I believe, is ready with a question from Matthias.
Yeah, hi, Matthias. How are you doing today?
Hey.
Are you there?
Oh, yeah, we're here.
Excellent. So I guess, you know, us chefs, we wear multiple hats, and perhaps the only profession where someone who's, you know, considered creative is called upon to do their own business as well. So I guess I'm curious, how do you personally, you know, manage this and keep all the plates in the air?
Well, I think that, you know, It was a wonderful experience, like at the fine dining level, and I think that what really, you know, interests me when I left was creating these really interesting, unbelievable experiences at a level of accessibility, and I think that it was something that I was, you know, looking to do. I think that there's some truth in fine dining that not necessarily don't require a huge price tag, like a really great, inviting environment, well-crafted food, you know, thoughtful beverage program, and really well, thoughtful, and engaged service. And I wanted to explore that that idea. You know, traveling around the world and eating at some of the great, you know, small restaurants in, you know, in Asia, where it's a mom and a father. It's the only two people in a 15-seat little izakaya, and having some of the wonderful, you know, some of the most incredible experiences of my life in those things. I'm saying, why can't we have this in the United States? Why do we always, like, why do we have to look at, like, doing this fine dining thing? And for me, it was, like, taking a step down and doing that. And I think that as I had that freedom and kind of area to maneuver, I found that being in, you know, in fine dining, like Chef Paul could definitely relate to this, and Michael, that the attention to detail that you need to do 3-star Michelin is incredible, and the pressure is incredible. But once you take a step back and you do kind of like we have like our Billy Sunday bar, and you put as much energy and detail into something like that, it doesn't need to be at that level. So I have a flexibility to manage the balls in the air, I guess, where when you're set up like at Trotters, you are in this kind of like box where it was very rigid and static. And I think that being creative and removing myself from that gave me the flexibility to be able to use those kind of things I've learned there, but in a larger scope. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you find it difficult to switch between the tasks or the hats? You know, like, for instance, the business aspect of it, the money aspect of it, maybe perhaps having to do with the schedule and purchasing.
Oh, yeah.
Versus the creativity aspect of it. And you know, there's several different hats that a chef has to perform or wear. And I guess I'm curious how do you go in between them?
Yeah, well, I'd say the transition was tough, for sure, because when you're in the creative mode and you're a chef de cuisine or executive chef, you're focused pretty much on one thing, right? And now I'm beholden to investors, and we have to make our paybacks, and we're dealing with law, and we're doing all these different things now, which, to me, I love this business, and I love restaurants, so I had a really positive attitude going into it. Like, I'll learn this. Just like I learned how to cook, I'm going to learn what it means to, like, go through a lease deal. I know what it means to, like, set up an ROI, you know, and to understand what that really means. I think that's it's exciting. So, you know, I look at, you know, I'm 50 years old, and as I went through the different chapters and opened it up, this is as exciting as when I was 20, you know, working in those great kitchens. I think that it's just, I feel exhilarated by it. So there's nothing that on my scope that I really kind of feel is negative and it drags me down. So I kind of like attack everything like I would if I was on the stove, you know?
Yeah, that's really unique in the sense that they say it's a left brain and right brain thing. And, you know, a lot of times people can't switch back and forth, and you seem really adapt and comfortable in that. And even though you've developed these wildly unique and different concepts, so you really seem to have mastered the ability to use your left and right at the same time.
I wouldn't say mastered. I'm working on it, but I'll never master anything. I like the journey and the process more than the end result.
Is there more pressures as now that you're a owner operator, more so than when you were a chef or a chef de cuisine?
Yeah, I would say they are a little bit different. I mean, it's definitely kind of like when you're a chef de cuisine, you're like, this plate has to be perfect, and you have to know the latest techniques, and you have to source the greatest product. And now it's kind of like, you know, when you go through a bad month and you don't have the cash, and you're like, okay, where am I going to get it from? Or, you know, investor payouts are coming. Now we have to throw all our, you know, kind of savings out there. And there's those pressures that I think that are equal to the pressures of, like, cooking 3-star food, for sure. Because that's kind of like, you as a chef, you want to be successful in all your realms. And I think it is as important to understand and be successful in the things that people don't see as much as the things that people do see.
Yeah, that's great. I feel a lot the same way about it myself, and thank you for sharing.
Sure.
So, Michael, I'm going to throw this one your way and then maybe open it up a little. You know, it seems to me there's – bringing this back to where we started this conversation with this tragedy that happened this week. And I will go a little bit more explicitly to that larger topic of mental health or, you know, people in crisis. you know, there seems to me to be this very interesting irony about ascending the ladder in a kitchen. When you come up in a kitchen, you are rewarded for not asking for help. That is one of the things that will make you a star as a young cook in a kitchen, right? It's, you talk to a lot of people who become great chefs and successful chefs. They'll all tell you the same thing. I'm the one who came in early to help. I was there an hour or two before my shift. I'm the one who, when they broke me at the end of the day, I stayed just to watch in a corner, and then someone pulled me over and started teaching me stuff, and the next thing I knew, I was on the line. You hear these lines like, a good cook can anticipate what the chefs need. On and on and on and on. This is, everyone's nodding as I'm saying this. And then you become the chef, right? Well, you can't do everything as the chef. You need help. And it seems to me, you know, I did an interview not long ago with the guys down at Contra and Wild Air, and they, you know, they hit it really young. And they were saying, you know, they've had a hard time adjusting to being chefs because they all of a sudden are in the position where you need to ask for help. But first of all, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what I'm saying. And then second, on how you give yourself permission to do that. And then I do wonder, you know, if this is part of what's part of these tragedies that we've had over the years, is if people, it's almost a, I don't know if it's a personality trait or if it's nature or nurture. I don't know if this is how people come into the profession or what the profession does to you, but that you're not inclined to say, hey, I need X, whether it's I need help cooking this thing or I need help personally. Does this resonate with you?
Yeah, it does. It's actually something I've been thinking about the last couple of days. And I guess the way I've been thinking about it is in the sense that as you sort of climb that ladder in the hierarchy of a kitchen, it's a pyramid, that you have fewer peers at your level. You know, as a line cook, you know, you have, you know, empathetic ears. You can commiserate, you know, as you've mentioned in past shows, you know, sometimes, you know, the coping mechanisms aren't necessarily all that healthy. But as you kind of climb the ladder, you know, if you're running the kitchen, you know, who do you vent to? And I think that could be something there. You know, certainly in my experience, and I think this just goes to evolving management styles as a whole, you know, I always felt like, even as if I was the boss of my own domain, I was still a member of the team. And it's really about, you know, through empowering the cooks that you're working with, and that's sort of a way of asking for help in a
right.
weird sort of way.
Paul, how does this, and I guess I'd throw in, you know, I was thinking about Into the Bone, I think maybe part of this, and it dovetails with what Jimmy and Matthias were just talking about, you know, the creative piece. You know, I remember in that book, we talk about when you were at Atlas, not only were you having to rebuild the kitchen team and deal with all of that, but you were evolving very much at that time. It was your first chef gig, and you literally practically lived in the restaurant. You slept overnight there. You'd wash up in the sink. You'd basically be there for a week and then go home and get a shower and a shave and come back because the focus was so intense. And that's a very isolated and isolating way to be. So how does this all kind of land with you as you hear this conversation about, I guess, the loneliness at the top, I would say, whatever that means to you?
Well, I mean, what I did at Atlas, I guess, wasn't normal for most people. It was out of necessity because we didn't have any staff when I first took over. But that's definitely not normal. I wouldn't do it again. you know, I think kitchens and restaurants, you know, it's a team sport. It's 100% a team sport. And unless you are able to make that transition between being good at looking after yourself to then switching at being good at looking after everybody else, it's a very hard one to learn. I wasn't the best at it when I made that initial switch, because, you know, the Michelin system teaches you to be hard, look after yourself, and it's almost like a battle with everybody else around you to one-up everyone else. It's all very alpha male, ego-driven type thing. As you go up the ranks, you learn that it's not about you. And you put, as Matteo said, your ego to the side, and it's about the team. And you put them first and yourself second. That's the way that I look upon it. And if you don't manage to get behind that and understand that without them, you're nothing, because they can run the restaurant without you. You give them the direction, but you couldn't come in and run it without them. You don't get anywhere. So I think that's a huge learning curve. And the pressures of that, associated with that, you can only understand by doing it.
Thank you for that. Yeah. With that, we've come to the end. I always say it, time flies when you're on the air. Michael, Paul, Matthias, thank you all for being here for what I thought was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Before we go, I just want to quickly thank our engineer, Liz Smith, for piloting the ship as always. Thanks to Storefront Music for our theme song, Heavy Metal Gumbo. If you have any feedback on the show or our chef with an idea for a segment, please write to me and Jimmy at hosts, H-O-S-T-S, at frontburnerpodcast.org, hosts at frontburnerpodcast.org. Again, next week, we're going to take on the article from First We Feast, which it's funny. Somebody tweeted yesterday, if nothing happens from this article, then it's just a cool article that everyone liked for 10 minutes. So we're going to do our part to keep that beach ball in the air, Jimmy, and maybe you'll jump in the pool next week.
I'm hoping so because, it reminds me, Mark Vetri entered into this conversation, not too long ago. And
almost a year exactly.
It didn't really flourish as much as when a food writer or a journalist brought it up. So yeah. I'm gonna stew on this and come back to you.
Okay. Well, we'll get into it however we can get into it. And with that, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you here next week on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.